The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You know, if the issue is Russian meddling in the elections, or it's what do we think about domestic terrorism, people go back to his open testimony and you can actually hear the words of the director of the FBI saying, this is what the FBI thinks about domestic terrorism or whatever the issue is. I think that's incredibly powerful, and it stands as a kind of benchmark for people to understand, put the politics aside, what do the professionals actually think about some of the most important issues we confront as a nation?
I'm David Priest, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 25th, 2020. For a quarter of a century, the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, or both, early every year, have hosted the Worldwide Threat Briefing, featuring open, unclassified testimony from leaders of the intelligence community about the biggest threats facing the United States. That is, at least until this year, when it is still unclear when the worldwide threat testimony will take place, if at all. To shed some light on the history, the norms, and the value of this open intelligence testimony, we gathered an extraordinary group of intelligence leaders who have done it, in some cases many times, and in one case, when his boss was fired and he had to fill in very quickly. They are former Director of National Intelligence, former Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and former director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, Jim Clapper. Also, former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, former principal deputy DNI, and former director of the National Security Agency, Mike Hayden, and former acting director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Andrew McCabe. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 513, Clapper, Hayden, and McCabe on the Worldwide Threat Briefing. Congressional committees receive a lot of testimony, even a lot from the intelligence community, but usually that takes place behind closed doors. But there's always been some open testimony based on events from 9/11 to Russian election-centered information warfare. But for more than two decades, one annual institutionalized forum for intelligence community leaders to share with Congress, to share with the American public, unclassified bottom line judgments has occurred. It's called the Worldwide Threats Briefing. Let's start with you, General Clapper. What are your memories from back then when you were director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and it was just you and the director of Central Intelligence, or the acting director of Central Intelligence, heading into the worldwide threat briefings that evolved into the Intelligence Committee institutions that we've had ever since?
Well, my recollection of the early days of doing these briefings in, by early days, early 90s, when I, as you mentioned, David, when I served as director of DIA, and I think the major observation I'd make about briefings then and briefings later, particularly when I served as DNI, was there seemed to be a lot less politicization. Members, you know, grinding particular axes. And there seemed to be, my memory is, and this is 30 years ago, was a lot less of that back then than is now the case. And I think that's just a general reflection of the partisanship that is pervading our political discourse, which has affected the intelligence committees. So that's the major difference I would point out.
In that first year that it was for the intelligence committees, 1995, and that is the foundational year that the committees ever since have referred back to as the beginning of this version of the threat testimony, it was interesting going back and looking at your statement to the committees. You highlighted three major threats: North Korea, the political military developments in Russia, and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction. But you went on to list other things ranging from the coming anarchy, which you cited to Robert Kaplan's article at the time, and a range of other issues around the world. It made me wonder, what's the process for racking and stacking which threats to emphasize?
Well, first, David, I'm really glad you provided a reminder of what I said in 1995, because I have no memory of it whatsoever. So thanks for that. That actually is a very apt question, because that became a big deal in the, I think, six or so that I did as DNI of these worldwide threat briefings. Which threat, which problem would you mention first? Because the question was that was the most important threat. That all, and I always tried to have some sort of caveat language, but at least in my oral statement, that didn't necessarily represent the primary threat, and that we can forget all the others. So the problem for the intelligence community is you got to keep your eye on all of them, and you don't get a pass if you miss one. But that got to be a big deal as time went on, which threat is mentioned first. So we deliberated over that, particularly in the course of the oral statement, about, you know, which one do we want to highlight. And there was some advantage to doing that, because, again, the media would jump on it. So we tried to take advantage of that by highlighting perhaps a different threat than we had the previous year.
Let me turn to you, General Hayden. It appears that as DHRSA, or as a director of the National Security Agency, you didn't testify as part of this tradition in that role, unless I missed a reference to it, but you did contribute certainly to the process of the intelligence community addressing these threats. So how did these worldwide threat discussions track in any way with what you were saying to Congress? And of course, how did those briefings, you in turn had to respond to how Congress reacted to them, and they probably gave some heat to you. How did they affect you at NSA?
Yes, that is right. First of all, every time it was the problem of terrorism, okay? And it was all terrorism. And maybe that's not a good way to define it, but it is. And the most memorable moment was in, I think, a year after 9/11, that was me, the CIA, and FBI. Mm-hmm. And it was all day. And it was a hard program to do that with.
And am I right that for most of these briefings, if not all, there is an open session and usually a classified session that follows? Everyone remember that?
Well, no, because in this one time, it was all open, and it was very, very hard.
Okay. Let me turn to you, Andy McCabe. Through this time that we've been talking about so far with the others in the late 1990s into the early 2000s, you were working at FBI, eventually managing in the CT division in the National Security Branch and the Washington Field Office. Did you have any input into these briefings, or even any awareness of this public forum for sensitive info, given that the only FBI director to brief, I think Louis Freeh did it once in the 1990s.
I think that's right.
And then Director Mueller started picking up after 9/11, doing a lot of these every year. But what was your perspective on this from that working level and the managerial level?
It's a great question. And I have to say that as a field agent working in New York City on criminal matters, it was not a major issue for us, you know, and
it,
you know, just was not the sort of thing that impacted our day-to-day work on criminal and organized crime threats in New York City. Maybe we should have been more focused on it, but I certainly became more focused on it when I came to D.C. and started working in the counterterrorism division. And then, of course, had the opportunity, unlike General Clapper and General Hayden, the vast majority of my experience with these briefings is from the other side. So it's in preparing the director to go forward and give that testimony. And then, of course, I I had to sit in and deliver one, notably one time right towards the end there. But it was really a vigorous process, particularly with Director Mueller, who consumed massive amounts of written material during his maybe month-long preparation for the briefing. And so all of that stuff, of course, has to be produced, and it has to be tasked out, and it has to be perfected and, you know, delivered on time. And then we would literally have teams of subject matter experts who would go in, and he would sit at his conference table in the director's conference room and sit in front of those teams for hour after hour after hour and just grill them like the prosecutor that he is over the details, which he had invariably mastered before we came into the room.
So let me flip that back onto the two of you. You were at the point where you were essentially doing the same thing that was just described for Director Mueller. Were you also taking individual briefings with teams to get up on these issues, or simply reading material that was provided to you in writing? First, General Clapper, how did you prepare for these briefings?
Well, for me, this is a huge deal, and I guess it always got my competitive juices up some, because it was kind of a, you know, stump sort of thing. And of course, when members can ask anything about anywhere on the earth, that's kind of a And did. So I had an extensive preparation process, which involved study books, and I did a lot of memory work, and I would have briefs on selected topics from the experts. This activity was normally honchoed by the National Intelligence Council, and the respective NIOs, National Intelligence Officers, would orchestrate these prep briefings. And I also spent a good bit of time laboring over the statements, particularly since we submitted two, an unclassified statement and a classified statement, and would agonize over, spend a lot of time studying those so I could make sure I had the contrast, the differences between the two versions in mind, because one of the big things you worry about in an open session is, of course, compromising sources and methods or something like that. So preparing for those hearings was a big chore, and I spent a lot of time prepping for them.
General Hayden, let me turn it to you. In terms of when you were principal, deputy DNI, helping John Negroponte, who was DNI, prepare for these, but then how it shifted when you became the director of the CIA, and suddenly everyone is preparing you to be at that table. How did you prepare in each of those ways?
Well, first of all, a lot of time, okay? Maybe a month and a half, and every day working on that. And so it's a lot of time. But also, too, it's an important thing for the people in the military and CIA to know this is important stuff. And this is one of the times we talk about this in America. And frankly, we don't talk about it enough. And so this is a good thing for us.
Absolutely. Andy, tell me about what it's like to do this in the acting role, because you were acting director the time that you went to the worldwide threat testimony briefings. You had to receive all this preparation, but you're in a strange position there where you're essentially wearing two hats. You have less time, perhaps, than someone would in a normal context. And you also feel, in answering the questions, you're almost committing whoever is going to follow you in the position to back up your answers.
Yeah, that's very true. So many years as one of the many subject matter experts, particularly on CT issues, coming in and talking to the director. And then for 2 years with Jim Comey, you know, as the deputy director, you're kind of the somewhat of the master of ceremonies for this preparation process. So you are in the room at the director's right hand for every series of briefings and conversations, and for kind of filtering and providing your perspective on the information that people are providing to the director. Because, of course, like any large bureaucracy, every group or team that gets their 15 minutes, 30 minutes with the director presents their issue as the most important thing on the planet. So it sometimes is good to have kind of your senior operations person there to put these things into perspective. So a lot of time over those 2 years in that role, kind of helping the director with his formulation of answers, thinking about issues that we would or would not include if asked about a particular area, things like that. And then literally overnight, with about 24 hours notice, finding out that I was going to sit in that chair and speak for the FBI was it was really overwhelming, particularly with everything else that we were going through at the time. With, you know, Jim was fired on Tuesday. I essentially had Wednesday to prepare, and then the testimony was on Thursday. And I found that Wednesday night, as we sat there for hours, pretty late into the night, that it is much easier to be the person sitting at the director's right hand, providing the pithy little formulation of an answer. That's a much easier job than being the principal, and you're on the receiving end of every brilliant idea in the room and having to kind of transact on all those things and balance them and remember them. It's a huge chore. And it's about halfway through the prep that night, I remember at some point I just said, that's it. I'm done.
I know it, or I don't.
I've got what I'm going to be, you know, what I'm taking into the room with me. And if I don't have it, I'm not getting it from this point forward.
And just for clarity, you didn't have a choice on that. You were going to that briefing. Is that your understanding?
Well, that was my position on it. I mean, I think I guess I probably could have said no. Under the circumstances, it would have been a horrible decision, so I never actually considered it.
Right. Let me use that as an opportunity to debunk one thing. General Clapper, you can help with this one. There's an impression out there that this is up to the intelligence community collectively, perhaps, maybe up to the individual agency heads to elect to appear, and each person can decide if they want to show up and help out. But how does it really work from your perspective?
Well, today it was never an optional thing. You know, if Congress requests your company, I got threatened with subpoenas a couple times, but never actually had one. But Congress decides who shows up at the witness table, and they issue the invitations. And that, my experience was, as DNI, that varied from year to year, depending on the issue of the day or their needs or whims. So there was no standard. I mean, you know, it would include always the DNI directors of CIA and the FBI as sort of the base group, but then others would get added depending on, again, individual committee's desires that particular year.
And through the years, there has been a mix. Even the director of the FBI, as I mentioned, was not a steady participant in the early years when the directors of the CIA and the DIA were there. But over the years, you had the person who ran the Bureau of Intelligence and Research at State Department, or INR. You would have the director of NGA a couple of times. The director of the National Counterterrorism Center showed up a couple of times at the hearings. Even Department of Homeland Security intelligence leaders, but these would float in and out over the years. Perhaps the oddest one, and I'll follow up with you again, General Clapper, perhaps the oddest one was in 2009 when, in the only case I could find, Denny Blair as DNI did both the Senate Select Committee and the House Permanent Select Committee alone. The only time when he's been alone at that table without the heads of other agencies with him. What's the value from your perspective when you were DNI and you always had somebody else next to you? What's the value of having the heads of those agencies with you to help answer questions?
Well, there are upsides and downsides. The upside is it's always better to have help. No one person is going to be the master of all the subject matter. So, you know, in that sense, it's a good idea to have help. Now that poses a challenge about how you choreograph and how you orchestrate who's going to answer what. The downside is I had a couple of colleagues on that were at the witness table that actually made me nervous because I never knew quite what was going to come out of their mouths that remained nameless. So that's the downside. But on balance, I think it's better to have more people there because one person can't possibly have mastery of all subjects, particularly given the diversity of questions that you often got from members.
The nice thing is there were only a few people at the table any given year. So we can literally create a list of who you might be referring to there and narrow it down pretty quickly. That's a fun exercise. Let me turn to you, General Hayden, and ask you a similar question in terms of your time there, particularly as director of CIA sitting at the table. The Central Intelligence Agency, along with the Defense Intelligence Agency, cover just about everything in intelligence. But there are more narrow slices for places like the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, NGA, or the National Counterterrorism Center. As director of CIA sitting at the table, did you feel like you had to jump in and offer a take on almost every question because you had analysts working those topics?
No, not really. Now, I can say something different, but most of the time, no, that's right. I was, you know, we were doing the same things. And by the way, we know one another. And so we get different thing every now and again, but really, not really. That's okay.
Mm-hmm. Andy, your perspective, when you had to show up with little notice, when there was a question that crossed that divide, I believe when you went, you were there with, it was a pretty healthy table. You had DNI Coates at the table.
That's right.
You had Mike Pompeo, then director of the CIA. You had the director of DIA there. I believe National Counterterrorism Center, Nick Rasmussen, was probably there, at least for the Senate briefing, and maybe others. So there were some areas where somebody could take a question, most notably CIA or NCTC. Did you find yourself looking over to them like, please take this one?
You know, that is a time-honored technique in any group briefing. Like, you never dive on a grenade that one of your partners has already reached out to take care of for you. So, sure, any question that came down the pike that seems obviously in someone else's lane, you know, you gratefully hang back and see if someone else steps up to the plate for it. At the same time, I have a distinct memory of arriving for that testimony that morning. Whether or not I would show up was a major story on the news. So in my office before we left the Hoover Building, it was on TV and people were speculating about it, even though I'd said I'd be there. And so when we got there that morning, there's kind of a holding room where the principals go and they, you know, you wait until they're ready to kind of march you out in front of the cameras. And I remember when I walked into the holding room, DNI Coates, he had this unbelievable look of relief on his face. And he came over to me and just said, I am so glad you're here, because I think everybody was expecting a lot of questions about, you know, what was happening at the FBI and what had happened to Jim Comey. And so once I walked in the room, everyone else knew that they could effectively avoid all those sticky issues. So it goes both ways. You help each other out. And it's always I have always found that it's better to hold your fire and wait. If you think, you know, the issue covers two lanes, it's better to wait and see kind of what other folks are going to say first.
To add to that, the art form that I evolved over my time as DNI is that, you know, I'd caucus ahead of time with those who were going to testify, so we'd kind of cover the ground. And the general agreement was that I would kind of be the fielder of questions. And I would, and oftentimes members, when they ask a question, and would direct it to somebody specific, and then there, you know, there's no issue there. Or if they just ask a general question and left it to us, I would, you know, if I didn't really know the subject, I'd do sort of a tap dance intro and then turn it over to somebody that I was pretty sure could answer it, and give a little time for the person to you know, get their thoughts in order. So there is, at least in my experience, there was kind of an art form to how to field and hand off questions.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're really in the role of point guard there, knowing your team, knowing who to distribute the ball to. And in the role of Director of National Intelligence, that makes sense, right? Because your role had varied. When you were director of one agency, the DIA back in the 1990s, appearing as a co-equal with the director of Central Intelligence or CIA director in most ways, it's different than when you are the DNI. What was the difference you felt, apart from just fielding the questions and distributing them, but in terms of your role, in a sense, coordinating the coordinated judgments of all of the agencies?
Well, when I was just mainly CIA and CIA. I would obviously defer to the director as the director of Central Intelligence. Mm-hmm. And unless it was a directed question, and then typically the DCI would, if appropriate, you know, defer a question to me or ask me for input or something like that. Well, it's a little different when you only got two or three people as opposed to, say, six or seven mm-hmm. Witnesses. Then it's a little bit more tricky on how you handle that. And again, although I spent a lot of time prepping, I didn't try to answer all the questions and you know, wanted where I could to defer to others just to get everybody involved. And in so doing, you know, portray both the substance and the image of a community, not just a bunch of disparate agencies.
Right. Andy, you mentioned that Dan Coats was the one, and I think it's telling that it was Dan Coats who said, "Boy, am I glad you're here," because as far as I can tell, he's the only person who's been on both sides of this exchange during the last couple of decades. That is, he was on the Senate Select Committee of Intelligence asking questions and grilling intelligence leaders during one of his terms in the Senate, and then he turns around and he's the Director of National Intelligence and probably realizing better than most the kinds of things that a senator wants to know, including what is going on at the Bureau, and sure glad that the acting director is here. How did you feel that the leadership of the DNI from your perspective was helpful, not only in the worldwide threat briefing testimony itself, but any follow-up that came from it?
Well, I remember those, particularly the conference calls, the video conferences we would have with General Clapper before Jim would appear at any of these hearings. We'd always, as the general mentioned, we'd have a very tight coordination going into the hearing. And, you know, as has been said, the principals know each other well. They knew kind of what positions, you know, where people were coming down on the issues. So there wasn't like baked in, you know, disagreement coming to the table. And I think that's important. And of course, you expect that point guard role of the DNI to, in addition to kind of traffic copping the questions as they come in and out. It was my experience both watching Jim deliver and, of course, in my own appearance at the threat briefing. In areas where we couldn't resolve the issue at the table and there was some sort of a follow-up or a do-out, a member, you know, was really diving for a level of detail that we could not provide. I mean, typically that's when the DNI would step in and say, you know, we'll get that for you. And it's very comforting as representing one of the agencies to know that the DNI and his staff is really on top of keeping track of that process.
Absolutely.
But if I could, just to reference one thing you mentioned, you can't overstate the significance of how the members drive the agenda. Mm. So although you put a ton of effort into preparation and the opening statements, you know, you spend weeks and weeks crafting
them. That's the part you control, but that is not most of the briefing.
Exactly. That is not the entire briefing. So we would also try to do a little bit of scouting ahead of time to find out if, you know, for instance, one particular member might be just deeply interested in human trafficking. And while that is a significant and important issue, it might not be one that we would pick for the top three or five global threats that we wanted to present at the table. But you knew if that member was going to be at the briefing, you needed to be able to go deep on how you thought about, you know, trends in global human trafficking. So those sorts of interests can really take you down into a rabbit hole that you've got to be prepared to deliver on.
Can I offer one other time? Porter Goss was also there, and this is the first time we did something with them, and it was different for us, and it was a good thing to do that, even from the CIA all the way to the Hill.
Yeah, that's a good memory. I forgot about Porter Goss being on the House Intelligence Committee before he, in turn, testified as Director of Central Intelligence. General Clapper, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about what Andy McCabe was just sharing with us about your perspective on research. Good briefers know you research the customer or the person you're briefing as much as you research your own topic, to anticipate questions, to understand how they're going to hear certain phrases based on their background. What research did you do to find out what members, were going to ask or what you were hearing from the staffers about what the members were going to ask and put you on the spot in front of an audience of millions?
Well, this is where having a solid legislative affairs office was crucial. And the rapport that they developed with particularly principal staff supporting the members. And depending on that rapport, you could get pretty good intelligence on what members' interests were, even what their questions might be. Mm-hmm. So that's what I relied on, was the work of legislative affairs staff in their engagement with the staffs of the members to the extent that they share with us. Now, some wouldn't do that. They didn't want to spill the beans. They wanted to catch us off guard or whatever. But because they get a lot of useful foreknowledge of at least the subject matter that you might be asked about. Now, having said that, if some expose about the intelligence community appears on the front page of the Washington Post the day of your testimony, then
that's a bad
kind of hard to prepare for that. And that that happened to me in my confirmation hearing for DNI. And so some things you can't prepare for.
Sure. Okay, let's turn to a few big general topics. General Hayden, I'll start with you on one. Unclassified testimony, I can say from personal experience as a Central Intelligence Agency officer, unclassified intelligence judgments are really difficult for many analysts, especially on true hard targets, those countries and topics with extraordinarily difficult collection challenges. How do you think we as an intelligence community did across all of the worldwide threat briefing sessions you saw at communicating, in some cases, nuanced judgments in an unclassified format?
Yes, that's a good question. We did okay, but it was very, very hard. Okay. Now, sometimes we just didn't know. And how do we do that now? Okay. That is a problem for us. Otherwise, many things we do know and we would actually say it. And I think that's a good thing. And actually, the Congress doesn't agree with that. That's okay. You do that best of all. And that's a good thing for us.
Mm-hmm. Andy, same question. How did we do at unclassified judgments in the briefings that you were a part of or contributed heavily to?
Yeah, I think we, like anything, we did well in some areas and not as well in others. It is, as the general said, it's an incredibly hard thing to ask your analysts to do. The analysts who, you really appreciate quality analysts when you are preparing for an appearance like this, people who can synthesize, not just present what we're finding in this case or that case, but people who can synthesize the work that we do and project it into strategic direction and anticipation of the threat picture. And so when you ask them, you always want from them, what is the sum total of what we know? But for this appearance, you're saying, okay, take that and subtract out really all the best and most sensitive information that we know and try to come up with a coherent picture. So it's a very tough thing to ask them to do. However, I think the way that I would typically talk to our analysts about it is to remember the audience. The audience is not used to hearing super duper top secret compartmented information, and they have a much less granular understanding of these threats. So it's still very important and it's significant for that audience, the general public, to hear what we think about the threat picture in broad strokes, because that may be the most they ever get on it. And that is, I think, an absolutely critical piece of our national security infrastructure. That opportunity to essentially deliver to the general public, here's what we think about the business we do.
Mm-hmm. General Clapper, were you generally satisfied with the unclassified judgments you were getting from analysts and managers to present in these briefings?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was part of the prep process with NIOs or analysts is getting some idea in my head about what is it I can say about this publicly and what should I avoid or try to protect. And it really puts you in an awkward position because if you're placed under oath and you're supposed to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, and oftentimes you can't do that for, you know, classification purposes. Mm-hmm. There's another dimension here I wanted to mention in this context about speaking in public. Over my 6.5 years as DNI, I think the White House got 3 complaints for either things I said or were in our unclassified statement for the record, which offended them. And you have to be mindful of that as well, where you may be intending to be actual and straightforward. But if you mention corruption in country X, country X might take offense at that assertion. Or if you have if you acknowledge a serious drug problem or the problem posed by drug cartels in Mexico, and the Mexican government takes offense at that. So you also have to consider diplomatic niceties, if you will, in these responses. Obviously, in a closed context, you can be much more offended, but you have to be careful about that in an open environment.
So to be clear, the offense you're talking about is offense communicated to the United States government from foreign governments hearing intelligence judgments about them and responding to it diplomatically, saying, we don't like that somebody in the U.S. government is saying this publicly.
Exactly. There were 3 specific instances of that during my time as DNI.
I thought you were saying that members of Congress only 3 times objected to your judgments. And I said, you know, sir, that's 3 times a minute that would have happened.
Well, that's another subject.
Entirely.
Right.
Yeah. Foreign governments taking offense at something that you might not think was offensive, but they did.
Well, let's close with a discussion of the elephant in the room. Why are we spending so much time on this annual tradition right now? It's gone on relatively smoothly, although not all of you will agree, because it sure seemed like the heat was on. But it's gone on for more than 2 decades. Well, reports indicate that this year's session, at least for the Senate, has hit a roadblock. The sessions for the House committee have had some issues for the past few years also because of that committee's dynamics. But this year, the session appears that it is either postponed or may not happen at all. And there's a lot of people saying that this is a problem. Let's start with you, General Hayden. What is lost to the Congress, to the public, even to the intelligence community itself, if this tradition is not continued?
Well, it's truth. That is truth. And we have to do that. It's hard, I know. The politicians don't like it much, but it's truth, and it's so important. And so with the CIA and NSA and other people maybe not doing that again, that is a real problem for us, because Americans need to know what we stand for.
Let me push back on that with you just a little bit to say, everyone here has described the huge amount of effort that goes into this, the certainly hundreds, if not thousands of hours of very senior officers within the intelligence community to prepare these, to brief you, to revise these, and to investigate what questions might be coming. That is a huge investment. And I think your point is, it is still worth it because of that wider, political and societal benefit of explaining intelligence openly?
Absolutely. That's the problem. And if we don't do that, then we are talking about the people not knowing what we can do for them.
Mm-hmm. And I'll ask you directly, did you ever have the president or someone close to the president tell you that they wanted you to change your intelligence judgments in the open testimony to Congress?
No, absolutely not. It doesn't happen. Well, it didn't happen.
David, typically the open statements are, at least in my experience, were run through Office of Management and Budget.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, in my time as DNI, I never had a case where there was a request for a substantive change. There were editorial changes or accuracy changes, but not the substance of intelligence. Now, I did have occasion where I said something in response to a question that the White House didn't like.
Mm-hmm.
National Security Advisor once put out a statement you know, differing with what I said, but they didn't ever direct me to correct it or amend what I said or anything of that nature. I think the important thing here is, to Mike's point, is, you know, it's almost a holy writ in intelligence about telling truth to power. And it really bothered me when I heard about when the reported attempts by ODNI to evade or avoid open testimony for fear of making the president mad because the intelligence community might say that doesn't necessarily comport with his worldview. Well, that's a very dangerous place to be. It's not obviously not good for the credibility of the intelligence community, and it, over time, it is not good for the nation's safety and security. So that's really what's at stake here. The other thing that was pointed out to me by a couple of committee chairmen is this is a one time a year where the American public can see the leadership of the intelligence community as human beings. And there's probably no other time that most of the public ever can ever do that. And in the minds of those two committee chair, that was an important reason for having these open hearings.
Let me turn to you, Andy McCabe. Same question in terms of what's the value of these open briefings? Certainly not easy to present some very difficult, in your case, FBI cases and assessments in this forum, but it has some value. What is that?
Not easy, but as you've already heard, absolutely worth it. And I would say beyond worth it, it's necessary. We live in a constitutional democracy, and one of the ways we keep that going is through transparency. When the government fails to be transparent about the work that it's doing, people have less of an ability to make educated, intelligent decisions about their interactions with government. So this is one of the few times the year, as General Clapper just said, that people not only get to see their intelligence leaders, but get to hear what they think based on the finest intelligence tradecraft that this government is able to produce. That all of that work product, all of that knowledge is owned by the people of this country. So they should hear what we think about the threats that we're confronting. And, you know, look, even today, for example, Director Wray's testimony, open testimony on issues is cited in news reports on every channel repeatedly. So anytime someone, you know, if the issue is Russian meddling in the elections or it's what do we think about domestic terrorism, people go back to his open testimony and you can actually hear the words of the director of the FBI saying this is what the FBI thinks about domestic terrorism or whatever the issue is. I think that's incredibly powerful and it stands as a kind of benchmark for people to understand, put the politics aside, what do the professionals actually think about some of the most important issues we confront as a nation?
And in addition to that purpose for the members of Congress to further that overall mission, you've got to think that members of the Intel Committee who aren't as public facing as they are on many other committees also do want to show their constituents that this is hard work, that we do oversight
That's
on
right.
this, but we're also getting good information from the intelligence community as part of this process.
That's right.
Yeah. General Clapper, General Hayden, Andy McCabe, thank you for joining us and talking about these briefings.
Thank you.
Thanks very
thank
much.
You.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Jim Clapper, Mike Hayden, and Andrew McCabe for coming on the show. Please share this podcast with people who have not heard about it, especially people who are interested in intelligence and don't get a lot of information on it anywhere else. This episode is edited and produced by Jen Pacha-Howell. Michaela Fogel, Jacob Schultz, and Elliot Setzer stepped up this week to make a very difficult logistical operation work seamlessly. Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.